everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on a serious issue, generally one that has not been explored, or not explored with any sense of insight, honesty, and fairness. Today, the FBI, the bureaucracy, and the intelligence failures of 9/11. Also, our growing surveillance state and spying on Americans. My guest, Colleen Rowley. She is a former FBI special agent who was with the agency for 24 years, from 1990 to 2003. She was the chief division counsel operating out of Minneapolis. In May of 2002, she blew the whistle and later testified before the Senate Judiciary about the FBI's pre-9/11 failures to track and investigate Massawi, who has been identified as central to the 9/11 plot. She stepped down from her legal position with the agency in 2004 after her unsuccessful issuance of warnings about the dangers of invading Iraq. In 2002, Colleen was selected by Time magazine as one of the three Persons of the Year award. She ran for Congress to represent Minnesota's 2nd District in 2006 with the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And last month, she went to Moscow, along with other whistleblowers, to present the Sam Adams Award for Integrity in Intelligence to Edward Snowden. Her website is ColleenRowley.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Having been both a special agent for the FBI, which included focusing on Italian organized crime and the heroin trade, as well as the chief counsel for the FBI district, you had certainly enough of the bureaucracy facing you on a daily basis to have a real insider's perspective. And while your office was raising concerns about Massawi, who should be investigated more thoroughly by the agency, you were obviously coming up against the bureaucratic layers higher up. So I'd like you to briefly share your experience with the FBI's bureaucratic structure and explain that structure and how it is curtailed in its functions by other federal agencies and departments, and then in terms of the FBI's ultimate mission to protect the domestic, or at least the Americans, in any form of threat.
Sure. Well, the situation before 9/11, which was governed by the Church Committee's Compromise Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, included something called the wall. And this was a prohibition of sharing information between criminal investigators and intelligence gathering. And there was actually a very good reason for this. This, again, was all part of the FISA, 1978 FISA law and the Church Committee. And that is because J. Edgar Hoover in the 60s, and, of course, even before that, you know, as well, but it got so bad in the 60s where he was actually using illegal methods to spy on Americans, people like Martin Luther King Jr., the feminists, the anti-war people, civil rights people, etc. And so when the Church Committee examined this, they said, well, this spying that occurs on foreign peoples, and of course, this is what we're hearing so much about in the last few days with the revelations from Edward Snowden, the NSA disclosures, that the United States, of course, spies on all of these foreign officials, German, Brazilian, Spanish, French, et cetera, as well as their people. And the reason for that is they don't have to follow really any real law. There are some treaties and some comity involved, and, of course, you could say good discretion as to whether you should spy on allies. Today, Glenn Greenwald was on Democracy Now, and he said this is just the NSA is out of control, essentially. They're just trying to collect information on everyone. But besides that, we have constitutional protections that govern American citizens. So this wall was to put a wall between the law that, frankly, prohibits illegal searches of Americans and also the First Amendment, freedom of press, et cetera. There's a lot of civil liberties that are ingrained in our Bill of Rights that protect American citizens. Well, after 9/11, the wall came down. So what existed before to actually protect this distinction And there's a lot of false, you know, misinformation out there about how if the NSA had just been allowed to conduct this massive spying, one of the main proponents of this theory is Dianne Feinstein right now. She's saying, well, if the NSA had been allowed to conduct spying without these prohibitions that restricted its ability to collect information about Americans, et cetera, we could have prevented 9/11. Well, I was the whistleblower, actually, about the scandalous cover-up of the failures of the FBI. The only thing I knew about was the FBI. I didn't know about the CIA and the NSA's, which are actually, frankly, greater than even the FBI's failures. I did know about this case in Minnesota. And so I wrote this whistleblower memo 8.5 months after 9/11 when the Joint Intelligence Committee was engaging in its inquiry. Actually, one of the people in the Joint Intelligence Committee was Dianne Feinstein. She was involved in the Senate Judiciary and asked me questions the day I testified, 2 weeks after my memo became public. And the bottom line is that after 9/11, they chose then to remove pretty much all of these prior illegal restrictions. And they did it illegally at first, but then over time, they got a lot of people, certainly the Intelligence Committee's complicity. They got eventually the FISA court's complicity with this, and to the point where they amended the FISA law itself in 2008. And the people of our country, as well as, of course, the people of the world, were largely ignorant about what was going on until Edward Snowden came along and disclosed how massive and how, with documents, how massive this spying was and how all of these, of course, really terrible potential consequences where you're hurting even trust now amongst the European community is at the lowest ever, just because they have now learned how bad this our embassies are spying right on German officials and German citizens, etc.
I appreciate the overview. However, I have some concerns, and I'd like if you would please to address them. First, let's just take a look at Dianne Feinstein and other people like Nancy Pelosi, both in the House and the Senate, those who had access to intelligence material, and the Speaker of the House certainly does, and as well as those who sit on both committees. You're dealing with over 30 individuals at least. Not one single person in all these decades has come forward to say, there's a problem. There's a problem where federal agencies are overstepping their mandates, are going beyond what is reasonably considered legal or ethical. They are doing things that should be investigated. Not once has there been a person who's whistleblown. The closest we came in a recent interview was with Representative Ron Wyden, who said, with an attorney present, well, I can't answer that question. Well, I can't answer that question. Well, I can't answer that question. The only thing I can answer is if the American public knew the full extent of everything, they would be, quote, surprised. Well, okay, why don't you have the courage to tell us what we would be surprised by? If you know that the government or its agents have involved themselves in illegal activity, do you not have an obligation to the Constitution? Now, maybe I'm mistaken. I'm not the lawyer. You're the lawyer. Shouldn't a person be held accountable to the laws of the land, including the laws of the Constitution, and not just the internal internecine conflicts or politics within an agency that tells them, don't talk about when J. Edgar Hoover committed crimes against humanity, including trying to set up Martin Luther King for a suicide, exposing the fact that he had had an affair and was going to try to go public unless he did the right thing, all the Operation COINTELPRO probes, those of us who investigate, and I am an investigative journalist for over 40 years, those of us who investigate regularly and do quality work, we were all aware. There's no secret that there was corruption, malfeasance, and illegalities within the federal agencies, including the FBI. Our concern was, A, the mainstream media refused to lead the way on reporting it. Members of the House and Senate and the executive branch refused to come forward and expose it. No one was ever really held accountable, no matter how many crimes they committed. And even on the FISA issue that you mentioned, how do you go after the fact when they've been caught, clearly caught, in an illegal after effort. How do you go back and then write a new law saying, okay, it's no longer illegal? Unless I'm mistaken, if you rob a bank and it's illegal, and then they say it's no longer illegal, the fact that you committed an act of crime when it was illegal shouldn't expunge that from your background. So we're concerned about the hypocrisy, the double standard, the complete absence of the rule of law anywhere in our federal system. Please respond to this.
Yeah, it's exact. You're very correct on all of your observations there. And in fact, two professors, I don't know if they were law professors or international relations professors, have recently written on the foreign policy site on a very credible, insider foreign policy site, that what we are looking at, Snowden's revelations, actually have undermined the ability of the United States, hypocrisy. That's exactly what it has undermined. Because hypocrisy is fundamental to this perception of American exceptionalism and as being above the law, et cetera. So if anything, the damage, nobody's life has been put in danger because of Edward Snowden's revelations about spying. They can't document anything like that. But what really is at play here is the undermining of the hypocrisy. Because again, it's a function of law. You mentioned this. Law is supposed to be applied equally. And so if you go back to the Nixon era, eventually Nixon had that notion that if the president does it, quote unquote, if the president does it, it's not illegal. He had that idea himself. Of course, this was before there were whistleblowers like Deep Throat and eventually insiders like John Dean. And it takes a lot in a situation where there is a massive group that are, there's people at the top giving orders, and you saw this with the torture regime where Pelosi was somewhere actually towards the bottom, even though she was one of the Gang of Eight that was briefed. And she was probably briefly briefed. She wasn't given the full details, but she was told about Bush's kidnappings and black sites and torture. And yet, absolutely, as you mentioned, she did nothing about it. She didn't mention a word. And then later when the power equation changes in Washington and her party's in power, she can't do anything to achieve accountability because she has been briefed ahead of time. If she was to have spoken out after when Obama, takes office and says, hey, we have to prosecute Dick Cheney and all these people that were involved in committing complete illegal actions of committing torture and even murdering people as a result of that torture, they would have pointed the fingers at her and they said, but Nancy, we briefed you. And this is part of this whole group dynamics going on where it's both parties, of course, also a number of private profiteers involved in both the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about, but even far worse now, this national security surveillance sector, which is kind of a little brother to the big brother. And so you have lots and lots of powerful forces out there. And, we were talking about Keith Alexander and Clapper. Both of them have been caught now in lying to Congress. But would a Dianne Feinstein or a Mike Rogers or Lindsey Graham or any of these people who are completely involved in this, would they ever say they have to prosecute Clapper? Or they could. There's laws that prevent lying to Congress. And in fact, Iran-Contra, there were attempts to prosecute people for lying to Congress. But if they were to do so, Alexanders of the world will point the finger back and say, but Diane, you knew all about this, and you went along with it as well. And you're right, Ron Wyden was the only one. He tried he tried as much as he could. He was scared himself, obviously. He was scared himself when they rubber stamp everything as top secret, and it's even more higher classifications than top secret. People all involved along this chain are all going to be very, very worried and scared about the repercussions for themselves. And you see what happened with Edward Snowden, for instance, where he's now, in asylum in Russia simply because he really can't travel anyplace else. He's really more or less going to have to stay there. and he has sacrificed tremendous amount to get the truth out. But that you can see why all of the cogs in this system it's going to require something, as happened with the Nixon Watergate and the ending of Vietnam, where it wasn't just Daniel Ellsberg and it wasn't just Walter Cronkite in the media saying this war is unwinnable, and it wasn't just the outing by Deep Throat, et cetera. It was a lot of things that came together from a lot of different angles, and I will say the public's protesting of the Vietnam War, et cetera, was rising up at the time. I'm hoping we may see this moment repeat now. I'm hoping that with the people learning now of these really atrocious violations of constitutional law that actually now impact themselves. It's not just Afghans and Pakistanis and Yemenis who are being victimized by some of these illegal things, but it's American citizens, it's French, it's German, etc. So we can hope that maybe we're seeing another one of these moments arise where there could be some accountability, as there was after Vietnam.
Thank you for that insight. I'm going to be cautiously optimistic, but I believe it will come at a different time for a different reason. If there was this uprising, you would have seen it already in some of the popularity polls. Congress has a poor popularity rating right now, but there has been no major actions to hold anyone accountable for anything, including Clapper lying before Congress. Now, from what I understand, he was not officially under oath, as many individuals are not put under oath, but it is still a felony to give wrong information, whether you're under oath or not, to Congress, and he did that. So it's still a felony, if not perjury. Separately, one of the primary motivations for you becoming an FBI agent was to support the agency's mission for providing national security. In fact, you were being highly recommended to serve on the Privacy and Civil Rights or Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which was a requirement in the aftermath of 9/11 Commission, and which would ensure that anti-terrorism efforts did not conflict or transgress the principles of the country's civil rights. However, the Bush White House did not appoint you to that panel. Since then, we are in fact witnessing a steady erosion of our civil rights. And in the name of the war on terrorism, and with the rhetoric that we must sacrifice some of our freedoms and civil rights in order to be better protected by the government. So I'd like you to spend more time explaining our surveillance programs, because in the case of 9/11, the arguments being given by high officials at the FBI and even George Tenet of the CIA was that there was too much intelligence available, and because of the massive amount of it, it was not being shared properly with the authorities mandated to act upon it. But then I'll turn this over to you to go into, at the very time that we were beating the drums to go into Iraq, I did several investigative reports. We had already determined that Curveball, the so-called, you know, insider who was telling us everything about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction was a fraud, that he did not pass a lie detector test, and that instead he was being set up through Dick Cheney's office, and contrary to what anything that George Tenet or the people around him was saying, the CIA, in effect, was of two minds. Those who were the rank and file working inside the agency who knew that this was not plausible, and we should not go into a war because Saddam Hussein was not harboring al-Qaeda, did not represent a threat to the United States, and had nothing to do with 9/11. And they had done that assessment. However, and this is what the public does not understand, Cheney and a group, including Tenet, had their own special needs intelligence division run out of the vice president's office, where they created the intelligence that would be then sold to the American public, and that this was also what was sold to Colin Powell. That's one of the things that Powell has never came completely forward on, though it is known that he is extremely concerned that he was used without being made aware that this was not the CIA's intelligence, this was Cheney's CIA intelligence. So it wasn't as if there was too much intelligence. It was that those who had a need for us to go to war for whatever their ultimate motives, and we probably won't know that until someone actually comes forward at some point and confesses, though that's highly improbable because the statute of limitations does not run out on crimes against humanity. And the consequences would be extreme. How do you take responsibility for having adversely affected millions of people's lives around the world between those that were displaced, the country that is in tatters, or nearly a million dead, and all the suffering that has ensued? No one's going to take responsibility for that. So that is the one issue, that in Washington, D.C., if you're powerful enough and if you have an agenda that you need met, you can take from different agencies the information and the resources you need to justify your arguments for whatever it is, spying on every American, reading every email. We were the first radio program, by the way, in the United States to confirm over 2 years ago that they were just not merely monitoring communications, that they were actually taking every single phone call, every single electronic communication, and keeping all that information. And then if they had reason to go back on an individual to look, they would have the entire history of that individual's communications. And the reality is, who has not done something that violates some ethical or moral or some law they may not even be aware is a law? And then that could be used against them. So the idea that you have nothing to fear, so don't worry about them listening on your calls, reading your emails, is foolish when you see how easy it is to bring indictments against people and look at the ways that they have used the 1917 Espionage Act to bring charges against some of the whistleblowers. So that
worse than that, they're actually now Keith Alexander is almost threatening that the government will now censor the news itself. He just was in an interview where he said, "I just don't know. We're going to have to find a way to stop this news."
Well, just a few moments ago, before this program began, a 30-year veteran of the New York Times, a person I know, came to the studio and was discussing all the whistleblowing that this person knows about the New York Times and all the stories they didn't run with and why. And I just found it interesting but not surprising. And so take your time now, go into this in some depth, and my final thought on this is this. I do not believe that we should be ascribing who did what where if we don't have that information, but if we do have some information, including on 9/11, that too many agencies had too much information and could have prevented this from happening, then why can't we ask the obvious question? Who benefited from them not acting on this information? Even if they did not directly plan things, but if they knew that plans were in the works and there was a likely outcome that this would happen, who would benefit if they allowed that to happen? Not a conspiratorial issue, simply one that I don't believe that you could have that many people who had that much pre-knowledge, that had that many leads, and have allowed this to have happened. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I'll start with your last point first on 9/11. I have actually called for another 9/11 investigation, and it's not because I have any, so-called conspiracy beliefs, and especially I don't have any evidence at all that bombs were placed or anything like that, or that there were no planes. But what has never been totally revealed is the amount of intelligence that these intelligence community had. The NSA, for instance, was allowed to be completely off the hook. They did look at the CIA and the FBI to some extent due to my memo. There's a 400-page Inspector General report about the FBI failures, but even that never found out a couple of key things. One key fact that was never found out is why were these two terrorists that were on the CIA's list and were actually initially came up in the Kuala Lumpur meeting of Al-Qaeda. CIA monitored it 2 years beforehand. And it was a very short list, by the way, of the CIA's terrorists at that time. And they never told the FBI that they had come into California and that it was known that they had entered the United States. This actual point is the one that Dianne Feinstein, and she's allowed to use this as one of her talking points about why the NSA should not be reformed and there should not be more judicious, careful monitoring. It should be massive and on everyone. That's her bill is actually to expand NSA spying as opposed to rein it in. She's using those points. She's using those because no one knows the truth. The 9/11 Commission only went so far. They really never exposed what the NSA knew. The NSA and other CIA and other agencies use this phrase, and you alluded to them saying they had too much info. They said, this was Rumsfeld and former director of FBI Louis Freeh, they all said, intelligence is like a fire hose, and when you have so much pouring out, it's hard to get a sip. That was their excuse after 9/11, why they could not connect the dots. There were warnings in the FBI, explicit warnings, beginning in April of 2001 that said bin Laden was connected to one of the Chechen terrorists. That actually directly connected to the Mousavi case because Mousavi had recruited people to fight for that Chechen terrorist. Now, years later, when these memos are pulled out and they said, what happened here? You didn't read this memo? Most of the people, the assistant directors, for instance, that, whose names were on the memo, this was actually directed to them. They claimed they hadn't read the memos. So we're not even talking about inability to share information, properly share information, as Tenet refused to share the information about the two hijackers that came into California. We're not even talking about failure to share or failure to act on key dots and key pieces of information. We're talking about failure to read the information. And there are memos like this April 2001 that now people afterwards, the Phoenix memo, was the same way in the FBI. Nobody at headquarters claimed that they had read it. So here we have an agent in Phoenix who says they're training in flight schools, and it was several pages long, and he had a lot of detail in there. A low-ranking, not even an agent, but a low-ranking analyst might have read it, but that's the only person that even would admit to having read that memo. So this is a huge problem, and this problem is really the excuse for why 9/11 could not have been stopped. You fast forward 13 years, and now after they turned the spigots on, so this fire hose has become Niagara Falls or maybe a tsunami, that it's millions and billions, and actually it's estimated now to be trillions of pieces of data that are being vacuumed up and put into this gigantic NSA computer. And they say that that's going to work better when their excuse after 9/11 was that they had too much information. There simply is something that's these explanations, people should look at these and say, this isn't making any sense at all. It's got to be quality, and you have to have humans that are able to read and analyze and effectively share and act on information. And it's all going the opposite direction. With the massive data gathering, it's gone completely in the opposite direction. And you can see that in the Boston Marathon bombing. You can see it with the underwear bomber. Even the Times Square bomber, the various terrorist cases that have happened inside the United States have not been prevented by this massive thing. They've actually been stopped by people in the public. Alert members, passengers, fellow passengers in New York. It was T-shirt vendors that noticed this car. So this is completely wrong what they're doing. And it also explains why the law itself, the Fourth Amendment, requires that there be a level of evidence or at least suspicion to begin to collect information about somebody, to target somebody. You can't just willy-nilly say the whole world could be our potential enemies and we're just going to collect as much as possible, which is now the NSA's motto. It doesn't make any sense because it's putting quantity over quality. If it's not relevant, all it's doing is cluttering up the databases. And so if you had a name, if you're an analyst and you do get the Abdul Muttalib, the underwear bomber, his own father calls up the State Department and says, my son is kind of lost it, and I think you should really be careful and look at him. Well, the names themselves, if you go now to your databases and you have trillions of names in there, it's going to be a much harder and more challenging thing to even figure out what the heck you're even looking at. When people think this is merely an ethical and legal issue as opposed to a counterproductive, it's not effective, it's actually harming our national security. I think that's important because most people want to trust. You're right, there's a level of distrust now of government, but also people do have this lingering mindset that they would like to trust certainly people that they voted for, their own congresspersons or their president or whatever. And so they find it real hard to believe that people would do things that wouldn't make any sense like this. The explanation, though, is there's profits to be involved. It's the same with wars. You know, it's what Eisenhower warned us about. And when you get a whole industry that is now making hand over fist money as a result of being told that the sky's the limit now, we can do anything we want, there's no laws involved, and a lot of different private, there's more private corporations involved in intelligence gathering than there are agencies involved. That's the motivation, and it's unbridled. There's little or no oversight because Congress, a long time ago, with the exception of a few senators and congresspersons who might have tried a little bit to kind of fight as much as they could against this, but they kind of gave up at some point and became complicit with it. The FISA court is a good example. They're a secret court, but even they claim that some of this was illegal at one point, but then, of course, it's secret, so nobody knows that. And they weren't told the truth either. The FISA judges themselves, one judge resigned as a voicing his complaint that he had not been told the truth. But it, as years have gone by, it's a real mess at this point. And these disclosures are hitting right now. And I, again, with people in the United States now realizing that it's not focused solely in a war, the propaganda is that they're telling you that this is only to, quote unquote, find the terrorists or to fight the Afghans or the Iraqis or the Yemenis or whatever. So that the Americans are told that this is on foreigners. And so Americans kind of shrug. They say, well, you know, okay, it's not on me. It's not my family. But when these disclosures are hitting home and showing that the American government now also wants to control American politics and American things, just as happened during COINTELPRO, just as happened during the 60s, I think that could conceivably make a difference. You're starting to see some waking up on that level, and you are starting to see some, I see it as the other thing is there's a cross-section. It's not just, Democrats or Republicans. The libertarians and the progressives are quite aligned now in trying to restore civil liberties.
Colleen, let me just reintroduce you for those who have just tuned in. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest is Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent for 24 years. She was chief division counsel operating out of Minneapolis. She's a whistleblower. And she just made a statement that I want to do some in-depth discussion on about who really benefits from this massive, not just military-industrial complex, but also the military-industrial spy complex. And it certainly is not for keeping us safe. In fact, all the legal scholars that I have reviewed this information with state that for every drone kill, we create 68 terrorists. Now consider that. First, the agency lies about the number of drones. Then they lie about who was killed. Now we have independent verification that the amount is 8 to 1, 8 civilians killed for every person that is considered a terrorist. And even that is not supported by any actual documentation because these people are killed based upon suspicion, not hard proof. But there is something else that's afoot here. Recently, I had a discussion on this. with a person who is familiar with the numbers of that represent the national defense budget, which is about $1.5 trillion when you take everything, not just the Defense Department budget, but all the other budgets online as well, and said that most of that goes to people who are inside the loop in Washington, meaning they either have no bid contracts, but once you have one of these contracts signed, you're virtually assured of keeping that money coming, no matter how inefficient your operation, no matter how duplicative it is of other efforts. When you get your money, you make sure that a certain amount goes to the lobbyists, the politicians, the people who helped get that. And that's one of the problems in Washington. Here is what Tom Engelhardt from TomsDispatch.com had to say, an article entitled Why Washington Can't Stop, The Coming Year of Tiny Wars and Micro-Conflicts. And then when I finish reading a little bit, I'm not going to read the whole thing, Colleen, I'd like for you to respond, all right?
Sure.
In terms of pure projectable power, there's never been anything like it. Its military has divided the world, the whole planet, into six commands. Its fleet, the aircraft carrier battle groups, rules the seas and has done so largely unchallenged for almost 70 years. Its air force has ruled the skies and, despite being almost continuously in action for years, hasn't faced an enemy airplane since 1991 or been seriously challenged anywhere since the early 70s. Its fleet of drone aircraft has proven itself capable of targeting and killing suspected enemies in the backlands of the planet, from Afghanistan and Pakistan to Yemen and Somalia, with little regard for national boundaries and none at all for the possibility of being shot down. It funds and trains proxy armies on several continents and has complex aid and training relationships with militaries across the planet. On hundreds of bases, some tiny and others the size of American towns, its soldiers garrison the globe, from Italy to Australia, from Honduras to Afghanistan, and on islands from Okinawa in the Pacific to the Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Its weapon makers are the most advanced on Earth and dominate the global arms market. Its nuclear weaponry in silos, on bombers, and on its fleet of submarines would be capable of destroying several planets the size of Earth. Its system of spy satellites is unsurpassed and unchallenged. Its intelligence services can listen in on phone calls and read the emails of everyone in the world, from top foreign leaders to obscure insurgents. The CIA and its expanding paramilitary forces are capable of kidnapping people of interest just about anywhere in any street in the United States or from Rome and Tripoli, anywhere else. For its many prisoners, it has set up secret jails across the planet on its naval vessels as well. It spends more on its military than the next most powerful 13 nations combined. Add in the spending for its full national security state, and it towers over any conceivable group of other nations. In terms of advanced and unchallenged military power, there's been nothing like the U.S. armed forces since the Mughals swept across Eurasia. No wonder American presidents now regularly use phrases like the finest fighting force in the world has ever seen to describe it. By the logic of the situation, the planet should be a pushover for it. Lesser nations with far lesser forces have in the past controlled vast territories. And despite much discussion of America's decline and the waning of its power in a multipolar world, its ability to pulverize and destroy, kill and maim, blow up and kick down has only grown in this new century. No other military of any nation comes within a country mile of it. None has more than a handful of foreign bases. None has more than two aircraft carrier battle groups. No potential enemy has such a fleet of robotic planes. None has more than 60,000 special operation forces. Country by country, it's hands down, no contest. The Russian army is a shadow of its former self. The Europeans have not rearmed significantly. Japan's self-defense forces are growing but tiny. And although China, regularly identified as the next rising imperial state, is involved in a much ballyhooed military buildup with its one aircraft carrier, a retread from the days of the Soviet Union, it still remains only a regional power. Despite this stunning global power equation, for more than a decade, we have been given a lesson in what a military, no matter how overwhelming, can and mostly can't do in the 21st century, and what a military with staggeringly advanced weaponry does mostly does not translate into on the current version of planet Earth. Let's start with what the U.S. can do. On this, the recent record is clear. It can destroy and destabilize. In fact, wherever U.S. military power has been applied in recent years, if there has been any lasting effect at all, it has been to destabilize whole regions. Back in 2004, almost a year and a half after American troops had rolled into a Baghdad that was looted and in flames, Ambassador Moussa, the head of the Arab League, commented ominously, "The gates of hell are open in Iraq." Now, although for the Bush administration, the situation in that country was already devolving, to the extent that anyone paid attention to Moussa's description, it seemed over the top, even outrageous as applied to the American-occupied Iraq. Today, with the latest scientific estimates of invasion and war-caused Iraqi deaths, at a staggering nearly 700,000 and many still dying, and with Syrian flames, it seems something of an understatement. It is now clear that George W. Bush and his top officials, fervent fundamentalists, when it came to the power of the U.S. military to alter, control, and dominate the greater Middle East and possibly the planet, did launch the radical transformation of a region. Their invasion of Iraq punched a hole through the heart of the Middle East, sparking a Sunni-Shiite civil war that has now spread catastrophically to Syria, taking more than 100,000 lives there. They helped turn the region into a churning sea of refugees, gave life and meaning to a previously non-existent al-Qaeda in Iraq and now in Syria, and left the country drifting in a sea of roadside bombs, suicide bombers, and threatened, like other countries in the region, with the possibility of splitting apart. And that's just a thumbnail sketch. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about destabilization in Afghanistan, where U.S. troops have been on the ground for almost 12 years and counting, Pakistan, where the CIA-run drone air campaign in its tribal borderlands has gone on for years as the country grew even shakier and more violent, Yemen, as an outfit called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula grew even stronger, or Somalia, where Washington repeatedly backed proxy armies it had trained and financed and supported outside incursions as an already destabilized country came apart at the seams in the influence of al-Shabaab, an increasingly radical and violent insurgent Islamic group, began to seep across regional borders. The results have always been the same. Destabilization. Consider Libya. We're no longer enamored with boots-on-the-ground interventions President Obama sent in the Air Force and the drones in 2011 in a bloodless intervention, unless, of course, you were on the ground, that helped topple Muammar Gaddafi, the local autocrat, and his secret police and prisons regime, and launched a vigorous young democracy. Oh, wait a minute. Not quite. In fact, the result, which unbelievably enough came as a surprise to Washington, was an increasingly damaged country with a desperately weak central government, a territory controlled by a range of militias, some Islamic extremists in nature, an insurgency and war across the border in neighboring Mali, thanks to an influx of weapons looted from Gaddafi's vast arsenals, a dead American ambassador, a country almost incapable of exporting its oil, and so on. Libya was, in fact, so thoroughly destabilized, so lacking in central authority, that Washington recently felt free to dispatch U.S. special forces onto the streets of his capital in broad daylight in an operation to snatch up a long-sought terrorist suspect, an act with which was considered successful as the toppling of Gaddafi's regime, and in a similar manner further destabilized a government that Washington still theoretically backed. And the overwhelming military power at the command of Washington can and is destabilizing whole regions of the planet. What then can't such military power do? On this, the record is no less clear and just as decisive. As every significant U.S. military action of this century has indicated, the application of military force, no matter in what form, has proven incapable of achieving even Washington's most minimal goals of the moment. Consider this one of the wonders of the modern world. Pile up the military technology, pour money into your armed forces, outpace the rest of the world, and none of it adds up to a pile of beans when it comes to making that world act as you wish. Yes, in Iraq, to take an example, Saddam Hussein's regime was quickly decapitated thanks to an overwhelming display of power and muscle by the invading Americans. His state bureaucracy was dismantled, his army dismissed, an occupying authority established, backed by foreign troops soon ensconced on huge multi-billion-dollar military bases meant to be garrisoned for generations, and a suitably friendly local government installed. And that's where the Bush administration's dreams ended, in the rubble created by a set of poorly armed minority insurgencies, terrorism, and a brutal ethnic religious civil war. In the end, almost 9 years after the invasion, and despite the fact that the Obama administration and the Pentagon were eager to keep U.S. troops stationed there in some capacity, a relatively weak central government refused, and they departed. The last representatives of the greatest power on earth slipped away in the dead of night, left behind among the ruins of historic consequences were the ghost towns and stripped or looted U.S. bases that were to be our monuments of Iraq. Today, under even more extraordinary circumstances, a similar process seems to be playing itself out in Afghanistan, another spectacle of our moment that should amaze us. After almost 12 years there, finding itself incapable of suppressing a minority insurgency, Washington is slowly withdrawing his combat troops, but wants to leave behind on the giant bases we've built perhaps 10,000 so-called trainers for the Afghan military and some special operations forces to continue the hunt for al-Qaeda and other terror types. In conclusion, for the planet's sole superpower, this, of all things, should be a slam dunk. At least the Iraqi government had a certain strength of its own, and the country had oil wealth. If there is a government on earth that qualifies for the term puppet, it should be the Afghan one, a President Hamid Karzai. After all, at least 80%, possibly 90% of that government expenses are covered by the U.S. and its allies, and its security forces are considered incapable of carrying on the fight against the Taliban and other insurgent outfits without U.S. support and aid. If Washington were to withdraw totally, including its financial support, it's hard to imagine that any successor to Karzai's government would last long. How, then, to explain the fact that Karzai has refused to sign a future bilateral security pact, long in the process of being hammered out? Instead, he recently denounced U.S. actions in Afghanistan, as he had repeatedly done in the past, claiming that he simply would not ink the agreement, and began bargaining with U.S. officials as if the leader of the planet's other superpowers and he were the same. And there's more to it, but that's enough. Now, last night on 60 Minutes, I saw what I considered reprehensible journalism, where the top man willing to speak out from the CIA, recently retired, who was overseeing all counterterrorism and was there with all the different directors for over 25 years and was not challenged on the National Security Agency's illegal activities, not challenged on the ethics of doing it, the morality of doing it, not giving any support to all the studies that show that we've actually increased terrorist activity and terrorism because of all the people that we kill and what we do to harm others who are innocent. He wasn't asked a single hard question. Instead, he was allowed to attack Snowden and others who are whistleblowers and get away with it. And the only concession he made was that the enhanced interrogation was something he would not have agreed upon and was wrong. But everything else was pro war on terror, pro all of our resources should go there. Your thoughts on this?
Well, one of the real pillars that we don't have anymore is an independent media. Our media is very much corporate. It is very biased, nationalistic. There's a great interview that I would recommend people read today between Glenn Greenwald and the New York Times former editor Bill Keller. And it's a lengthy interview, but it's very important to read. Actually, Bill Keller, who I'm not a big fan of because he was a supporter of the Iraq War and a lot of this warmongering and stuff, but he does make some decent points in there about journalism. And, of course, Glenn Greenwald makes the very points that we need journalists now to be aggressively truth finders and to actually challenge power. That's supposed to be their role instead of going along with power and basically being mouthpieces for power. So it's a great thing, and it is the problem. I actually was on a 60-minute segment right before the Iraq War that, you know, they were over here for hours filming this. It was Scott Pelley, and that interview never aired on 60 Minutes because it went against the memo that we have to be for the Iraq War. It was just days before it. So this is a problem. We need independent media. We had at the end, certainly at the end of Vietnam, that was a key factor. Walter Cronkite was trusted by a majority of people, and when he came forward in 67 or 68 and said, this is a bad war, this is unwinnable, people then started to listen. And we don't have that right now. We have, of course, fractured media. We don't have an ability to get the common person. Most common people don't have the time, for instance, to listen and watch a lot of different sources and basically be like CIA analysts and have to come up with their own conclusions. They want to listen to one source that more or less confirms their what they already believe. So Tom Englehart, by the way, was spot on. His description of our empire. There are people that say it's slowly, you know, crumbling in some ways. There are others that say, no, this could still, like the Roman Empire, go on for decades or hundreds of years. But the point he was making is that military power is not the answer. A hard use of bombing, you'll always hear, you know, even generals say that we can't bomb our way to winning this war. There has to be a political solution. Many times they'll concede that. That's a common thing. Well, we can't bomb our way. Well, of course you can't bomb your way. All you're doing is creating enemies. The drone bombing in Yemen has tripled or quadrupled the number of al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So, of course, it's impossible to use this hard military power. It's true the United States has it. They have a lot of hard military power, including, you know, enough nuclear bombs that could destroy the earth many times over, and there's no doubt about that, but it's fairly useless. And the other thing is this political, what they'll often say is winning the hearts and minds. If you really want security, you're going to have to, quote-unquote, win the hearts and minds of other people. Well, the United States is failing miserably on this level. Look at our own allies now are going, are mad and very disappointed in the United States. So we're even losing our allies, let alone winning the hearts and minds of the people who are subjected to drone bombing, et cetera, in Pakistan and in other places.
My final thought, because we're coming up near the end of the program, it is now practice within the FBI to set up terrorist watches on anyone who's engaged in any form of lawful protest, such as environmental protest, also collecting data on anyone protesting genetic engineering, also farm animal rights. If you are a person who supports and actually reports on or exposes cruelty against animals on factory farms, you are then being watched. Your organizations, and this is from Freedom of Information documents, from FBI. So for many of us, what we see the culture inside the FBI is a certain sense of arrogance, almost a sociopathic conceit that they can monitor anyone and that all Americans who protest or speak out are now considered suspects against the state. This is this is ultimate Orwellian. Seeing, your final thoughts on this?
Yes, we're essentially seeing that the 60s, and you said conceit and arrogance. Well, that defines Hoover. When you have this power, it will always be abused. The FBI, under FOIA documents, shows that they were looking at Occupy in Boston and missing the Sarnoff brothers. So Russia warns that these brothers could be terrorists, et cetera. And meanwhile, the FBI, again, you're right, it's massive data collection. They get credit and statistics by opening cases, by adding people to terrorist lists, all these things that, you're talking 20 records, the FBI has 20 records for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And the reason is they collect paychecks, and they get credit for doing these things. Now, our systems have to be reformed from the bottom up. It won't do any good to fire the new FBI. The old FBI director for 12 years has just left, and there's a new one in, but he's basically a clone of the old one, James Comey. He's very, very similar. So that's not going to do much good just to fire and put somebody else in who's exactly the same. This is going to require a massive people are the only answer here. Our government entities are not doing their job. So this is going to require people to take the lead, just as happened at the end of Vietnam and at other points in history. I would say actually even the American Revolution is on point, because the colonists in the United States became angry because of their taxes and stuff. And you know why? It was because King George was waging foreign wars.
You're right. Colleen, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your courage in coming forward and speaking out honestly about the corruptions, malfeasance within the FBI. And the website is Colleen, C-O-L-E-E-N, Rowley, R-O-W-L-E-Y.com. All the best to you. We look forward to another conversation. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.